From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with
Fresh Air.
On today's Fresh Air, we begin a holiday weekend series,
Rock Gods of Rock.
It's a Fresh Air way to heaven, with legends of hard rock and heavy metal shredding thoughtful interviews. It's not just an archive series, it's 4 days of
reruns of power.
Today we'll hear from Rob Halford of Judas Priest, one of the originators of heavy metal. Boy, did he surprise his fans when he came out. And we'll hear from James Hetfield of Metallica, the band that hired a therapist to keep them together. The Gods of Thunder are hell-bent for public radio as we begin this special Fresh Air series. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Crank up the volume, because today we begin our holiday weekend series on hard rock and heavy metal.
Judas is rising!
As the lead singer of the British heavy metal band Judas Priest, my guest Rob Halford became famous for his powerful voice, the leather, studs, and handcuffs he wore on stage, and the way he often made his stage entrance on his motorcycle. Judas Priest is one of the originators of heavy metal and one of the most theatrical and successful bands in the genre. Famous for such songs as Hellbent for Leather, Ram It Down, You've Got Another Thing Coming, and this one from 1980, Breaking the Law.
There I was completely wasting, out of work and down. All inside, it's so frustrating, as I drink from town to town. Feel as though nobody cares if I live or die. So I might as well begin to put some action in my life. Breaking the law.
Some parents took Priest's evil boasts at face value. The parents of two young men sued the band, claiming one of their records convinced the young man to commit suicide. In 1990, the judge ruled in favor of the band. Rob Halford started singing with Priest back in 1971. He left the band in the early 90s and later surprised his fans by coming out. Being gay sure didn't fit the stereotype of the heavy metal god. Halford returned to Judas Priest in 2003. I spoke with him in 2005. So what's it like more than 30 years after you started in Judas Priest to be, you know, putting on the costumes again, the leather and the, you know, the studs and the collars and all the stuff. And then to be singing these kind of, these anthems that were like teenage anthems of defiance for your audience. Yeah. But so many of the people who were your fans early on are probably in positions of authority themselves now. I bet there's a lot of, really, I bet there's a lot of like cops who are your fans and teachers who are your fans and parents who are your fans.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And you've just named three parts of society which attend frequently Judas Priest shows.
And used to be terrified of you, right?
Yeah,
like the police
maybe
of that
era. Exactly. Yeah. You wouldn't believe the amount of law enforcement that loved Judas Priest, especially here in New York City. And here we are, a band that wrote this song called Breaking the Law.
Right, exactly.
It's quite remarkable. But I think beyond that, there's this incredible bond that is maintained with our fan base internationally.
One of the things that has changed is that you're out now. And this is the first time you're performing with Judas Priest since you've been out. And do you think that changes anything for you and the band, or changes the way your audience sees you?
Well, I think it destroys the myth of, you know, the so-called intolerance and homophobia that was supposedly existing in heavy metal. Having said that, I think that if I'd have done this earlier in the 70s or the 80s, things may have been a bit more difficult. But that's a kind of a debatable question, because we never really confronted the issue at that time. I wanted to do it for myself, like any gay man or lesbian woman, and anyone that wants to, you know, bring this forward and make a proclamation is it's what you're entitled to. It's your own right, so to speak. But I was always protective of Judas Priest. I always felt that had I done this any earlier, or had I done it in different circumstances, the fallout would have damaged the band, and I would never do anything to hurt the band or its reputation or its following. So I think that you know, the timing was right, and just for me personally, it was a great moment of release.
You know what I love about the fact that you did come out is, I think for so many teenage boys, heavy metal is not only about the music, it's about, you know, these fantasies of like orgies with women, you know, and having all the women and how you're going to treat the women.
Yeah, the sex and drugs and rock and roll thing.
Yeah, and you know, if nothing else, it's like your coming out really complicates all of the cliches about, you know, the sex part of the sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And it takes it out of this kind of simplistic, sometimes misogynistic fantasy that I think teenage boys have.
Exactly. Well, Without labouring on one element here, just the teenage boy element, because of course the thing about Judas Priest's music is that we're not the same as every other heavy metal band. I think we've created our own niche, our own particular stamp, identity, trademark, whatever you want to call it. And if you look at the broad catalogue of this band's material, some hundreds and hundreds of songs over a three-decade span, I think that that's just one small focus of area.
Well, a lot of your songs have this kind of like mythic quality to it.
Yes, they do.
Like even the song Hill Rider, which we opened with from the new CD. I'm just going to forgive me as I read some of the lyrics.
Please do. Go ahead.
Okay. Hill Rider, you slot them all extinguished. Wrath of doom in killing fields they consume for valiance never yield. Triumph to the gods vanquished of enslavers.
Absolutely.
So,
well, there
it's
you go.
Overblown mythic language.
Isn't it wonderful? It's wonderful, but you see what the overriding story is there. The overriding story is of optimism, and the overriding story is of defeating anything that that stands in your way, that prevents you from achieving your goals or your dreams. And
But this has really like archaic language. You slot them all.
But that's because I love the English language. My favorite book is the Thesaurus. You know, I'm constantly looking to find words and language that some bands would maybe hesitate to use, or they're not able to because of the arena that they work in.
Now, there's the Judas Priest sound. There's also the Judas Priest look, and I mean, you were one of the creators of that look of wearing, you know, the leather and the studded collars and the handcuffs and the choke chains and, I mean, all the stuff that almost looks like fetish gear.
Well, it is to some extent.
Yeah.
Although maybe not so much now because...
Because it's a genre now.
It's because I can spend some money on some outfits, whereas before I had to go to the local S&M shop and pick up something for £2. That's the truth of it all. Yeah, I used to go down to my local Mr. S shop in London and put 10 quid down and try and grab a little bit of this and a little bit of that and slowly put it together, you know. But yes, that's something that we're very proud of. For a number of the early formative years of metal, the image was not really tying in to the fierceness and the strength and power of the music, and we kind of stumbled upon it with a song called Hellbent for Leather, which is very much a biker anthem song. We actually started to use the motorcycle at that point too. So all of these things kind of connected and created the heavy metal look. So yes, blame us for that.
And this isn't meant to be as personal as it's going to sound, but was all the leather and handcuffs and fetish gear an expression of your personal lifestyle or just good theatrical costuming?
Well, that's a very good question. I'm sure if there was a couch here for me to lay on with a psychiatrist, he'd probably go, yeah, that's what you were doing, Rob. Who knows? I don't know. As I said, it was never part of a deliberate intent for me. But yeah, I would hasten to say, because you're the first person ever to ask me this question, that subconsciously that was my way of saying, look, this is who I am. But in my outward kind of conscious level, that was never a thought, because that would have meant that I would have been using the band and my look for some kind of agenda, which I've never had.
When you say that it was in some ways a level of who you were, was it like a fantasy level of who you were, or?
Oh yes, yes. Well. I don't know. This is just kind of an open, free-forming kind of thought here. No, I mean, I'm not particularly attracted to that world or that fantasy element of what that lifestyle presents. It's just of no interest to me personally. It's all about, in all honesty, the fact that putting all that stuff on and looking at yourself in a mirror before you went on stage felt absolutely the right thing to do.
Well, since you've mentioned Hellbent for Leather, I think we should hear it. So this is Judas Priest, Hellbent for Leather.
Never known that human weight, engines ticking over, hear the roar as they sense the fear.
Wheels,
echoes of steel and a flash of light.
Screams
from a streak of fire as he strikes.
Hellbent, hellbent for leather. Hellbent, hellbent for leather.
That's Judas Priest. The band's lead singer, Rob Halford, will be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Rob Halford, the lead singer of Judas Priest, one of the originators of heavy metal. Judas Priest shows are quite theatrical experiences. How did you head in that direction of making it, like, theatrical?
Well, it just comes from being a kid, you know. I mean, when I was in my early grades at school, I was able to get into the school choir and be a part of all of the school productions, much like a lot of kids do. And I just ran to that. It made me feel good inside. So there was a point in my life when it was a kind of a toss-up between whether I was going to actually go from school, high school, into drama school and drama university in England. But I chose to go with music because that was the love of my life at that time, and it still is today. So I think I bought that theatrical desire with me to Priest, and I was always, you know, at the band meetings pushing for this lighting effect or that stage set or these costume ideas or these smoke machines or, you know, pyrotechnics, whatever it might be, whatever is really theatrical came from my love of the theatre and the magic that it can make.
For listeners who haven't seen your show, can you describe one of the most theatrical things?
We have a moment going on in this current Angel of Retribution worldwide tour that we do. There's an opening cut from Angel of Retribution called Judas Rising, and I appear behind the drum riser on a 50-foot hoist, a man lift, a pneumatic man lift, and at the bottom of the hoist is this theatrical flame fire effect. And so there's an intro. There's a piece of intro tape that works with that song, and the man lift, as it's called, is being taken up to about 50 feet, and there's all of this smoke and fire billowing around my feet, and I'm wearing this outfit made out of pure reflective chrome, and hit with two or three spotlights against a backdrop of this larger than life, 100 foot wide reincarnation of the Angel of Retribution artwork, and it's absolutely spectacular. I mean, I can see the reaction as that all comes together, and that's just one element of a two-hour Judas Priest performance that the fans love.
Is there part of you that stands back and says, God, this is really funny?
You've got to have a Spinal Tap mentality. Spinal Tap helps, yeah, because, you know, you've got to be able to laugh at some of these things and smile and enjoy them, which is not to kind of take it as a joke or to humiliate it, but you've got to certainly be able to kind of smile at some of these things that you do. But in a loving way, in a way that you're cherishing the moment and you know the effect that it's creating and how it's making you feel yourself as you bring that effect to life. But yes, certainly, every band has a copy of Spinal Tap on the tour bus.
So at its best, what does it feel like to come, rising out from on this like hydraulic lift in your chrome costume with spotlights shining on you? Like, what does that feel like on a really good night?
Well, I'll tell you what it feels like, Terry. It feels like, I hope the lift doesn't jam. I hope the smoke machine doesn't blow up. I hope my microphone works at this height. That's what it feels like. It's a complex It's a complex run of emotions right up till I start singing the song. But once the song is in full roar, it's just a very powerful, dominating type of explosion that goes on for the duration of the song. It's a very powerful song for us to perform because I think it embodies a lot of the reunion aspect that we're still enjoying right now.
So are there moments in performance now where you feel, I am a heavy metal god?
Oh, yes. Every time I get dressed before I go on stage, and I think that I can say that in all honesty. That doesn't mean to say I'm a schizophrenic or split personality, but definitely when you get dressed to go to work, your persona changes. You're getting psyched up. Your attitude is being prepared mentally. And much like a boxer going to the ring or a basketball player going out to court, you know there's a job to be done with your teammates and you're going to win. And so definitely there's a feeling of confidence and a certain makeover that takes place.
You know, with Judas Priest titles like Hellion, Eat Me Alive, Devil's Child, Breaking the Law, Screaming for Vengeance, Beyond the Realms of Death, A Touch of Evil, Sinner, we can all see why parents in the 70s and 80s weren't necessarily thrilled that their children were listening to your records. What effect do you think your music has had over the years on your teenaged fans?
Well, our teenage fans have grown up now and they're healthy, stable, balanced, family-oriented fans. They bring their children to our concerts. So if that isn't proof that Judas Priest has stood by nothing other than giving people some escape and some great nights out when they see us live and some very personal enjoyment at home on the headphones or on the speakers, then I don't know what else to say. I'm at a loss for words. It kind of puts to sleep that moment in the 80s when this, not only this band, even individuals like Sheena Easton were attacked by a political agenda that really had, in our opinions, some misconceptions. There was the one side of it about protection, which was running very close to censorship. But we all approved this PG rating. We thought it was a great idea because some of us were using language and ideas that that we felt was important to attach some kind of notification towards. But those songs that you've mentioned are but a handful of some, I don't know, 200-300 recordings that we've made over the years. Little things pop out more than others and things get more attention than others.
I want to get back to something we were talking about a little earlier, which is coming out. And what year was it that you actually came out?
Do you know, I can't be absolutely precise. I would think it was around 93, 94.
Okay. I imagine there were a lot of times when you were in a really awkward position. I mean, for example, most bands have groupies. I'm sure there were so many women waiting for you, like actually throwing themselves at you. And, you know, how do you make it clear of that? Like, you know, no thanks.
Well, that's it. I mean, I'm a very polite British gentleman. No, thank you. It's as simple as that. And I'm kind of proud of that. I'm very proud of myself that I didn't go out onto this kind of extreme limb of displaying myself in a way that was not truthful, which is to say that, you know, I wasn't caught in those kinds of situations just because I felt it was important to portray myself in a certain way, being a singer in a famous heavy metal band. I couldn't do that because, again, I would have been using myself, I would have been using a lot of different things that go against my own particular standards. So, yeah, you say no, thank you, you know, and leave it at that.
Did you feel cut off from other gay people? Because if you felt you couldn't come out, it probably meant you couldn't hang out with a gay crowd.
And, yes.
And so, like, you know, what do you do when you're on the road? Who do you?
Well.
Who do you hang out with?
Again, this is all about surroundings and circumstances, isn't it? Because that was a world that I didn't really walk towards or begin to investigate until I was probably in my mid-20s or so, which might sound amazing to some people, but it never really interested me. I'm still I'm a conservative gay man, and you know, bars don't interest me, clubs don't interest me. I'm still, to some extent, invisible within the gay community, and that's because I don't really seek to be, a spokesperson for whatever things are being discussed by other celebrities by walking out night after night in front of thousands of metal fans all over the world as a gay metal singer. That to me is my cause and my moment for celebration.
Rob Halford is the lead singer of Judas Priest. Our interview was recorded in 2005. Our hard rock and heavy metal series continues in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of the Aeneid, Virgil's Epic of the Founding of Rome, in stores and online at bn.com. And from the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Metallica's lead singer and guitarist James Hetfield will talk about the history of the band and the anger and exhaustion that threatened to break it up. That period was chronicled in the documentary Some Kind of Monster. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The band Metallica, the biggest-selling rock act of the 90s, has survived for over 25 years. My guest is singer and guitarist James Hetfield, one of the founders of the band. As the Rolling Stone Encyclopedia of Rock and Roll says, after gaining a solid cult following among fans who could not identify with contemporary pretty boy pop metal combos such as Van Halen and Bon Jovi, Metallica became known for its sophisticated, often complex song structure and serious lyrics that reflected teen obsession with anger, despair, fear, and death. I spoke with Hetfield in 2004, the year that the documentary about the band was released on DVD. That film, Some Kind of Monster, chronicled the making of their album Saint Anger, and the anger, tension, and exhaustion that nearly broke up the band as the members neared middle age. The band actually hired a therapist to do group therapy sessions. During this period, Hetfield checked himself into rehab. When he emerged, Metallica completed Saint Anger. Here's a song from it called Some Kind of Monster.
These are the legs in circles run. This is the beating you'll never know. These are the lips that taste no freedom. This is the feel that's not so safe. This is the face you'll never change. This is the God that ain't so pure. This is the God that is not pure. This is the voice of silence no more.
James Hetfield, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start at the beginning of Metallica's history. What did you want Metallica to be?
Oh, boy. I wanted it to be freedom from school, from work, from the typical music that we were hearing. But really, it was music was somewhat of an escape for me that turned into a really great gift eventually. But it was a way to get away from my screwed up family.
What was screwed up about your family?
No one really communicated very well. It was very insular, very somewhat elitist in our religion. That's what they believe, but we believe this, which is better. You know, which is Christian Science. I grew up in that type of atmosphere. And I never really understood it either. So I felt very alienated from the outside world and from my family. So it was a connection, music for me was. But Metallica, when we hooked up, we were just passionate and loved music. And it was the soundtrack for our lives, you know, that it spoke for us.
And how old were you when the band started?
Let's see. Fresh out of high school, so 18 or 19, we started.
So no college?
No. We had college on the road, basically. Street college.
So you said that music was also an escape from work. Was this an escape from the work that you would have been doing had you not been in a band, or were you already working?
Well, I was working, and my dad left a note saying he was leaving at age 13. Never really said goodbye. My mom passed away at 16. I went and lived with my older brother, and she left some inheritance for me, but it was so tough to even want to touch that. It was like that was still mom. I didn't want to mess with that. So I went and I got a job working at a high school, moving a high school. Then it was custodial work. Then I went working in a factory because I had the long hair. That was pretty much all I could get. And, oh, it was so frustrating just sitting there. It was okay. I at lunch would go out and write in my truck, mm-hmm. write some songs. But I remember seeing this older guy working as the foreman. He one day you'll be foreman. Ooh, joy. Yeah. You know, and he's 40, 50 years old, and it's like, man, I cannot do this. I have to play music. It was in me. I knew it had to happen.
No, I don't think you ever got into the kind of Spinal Tap type of show busy, heavy metal stuff with the breastplates and the cod pieces and right. I mean, you never were into that, right?
Well, under my jeans.
Under your jeans, yes.
Well, we did some tours.
You're more
bands.
Like t-shirts and jeans.
Basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, we would walk on stage and play with what was comfortable. You know, wearing a spiked wristband with. With nails sticking out of it, you really couldn't wipe your forehead off with that, you know. It wasn't comfortable, you know. At the end of the day, we wanted to be, you know, just us. And you know, we had done some tours with bands. And growing up in L.A., it was kind of everywhere. And that was a little bit tried to sneak in, you know. I had bullet belts, you know, because Lemmy from Motorhead had that. That was the extent of our dressing up, you know. But
did you have your destructive period of destroying hotel rooms? And
oh, yeah. Oh, definitely. A lot of our early lyrics were all about that, you know. On the road, show up in a city, rape, pillage, move on, you know.
Now, what's your explanation for why you wanted to do that?
Oh, because I guess we could. Because I guess we were angry. We needed attention. And partly because you were supposed to, you know. We'd heard about, you know, the decadence of the 70s bands, you know, going in. And they had orgies. They had, you know, they were throwing TVs out of, you know, you heard all those stories. And we didn't really throw any TVs out of windows, but we jumped out of windows into pools, breaking bones, you know, setting off hotel alarms and at 4 a.m. and having to pay for everyone's room, you know, things like that, you know, kicking holes in walls, whatever, all kinds of just, you know, kind of releases. And after a while, it became a trap. You know, you're on tour paying for your destruction, you know, and you're not bringing any money home. So
did you enjoy it? Did you enjoy destroying things?
There was something about it. And it tied in with my anger a lot. And I had a lot of anger and rage problems that would just overcome me. And I would, whatever was near, I'd throw it and it would break. And it was just this adolescence that stuck with me, you know. And, you know, when I finally started, dating my wife-to-be, who is my wife now, Francesca, she, you know, it was embarrassing. It was embarrassing to myself and to her, and she helped me grow up quite a bit. But yeah, there was something about smashing stuff that just felt right. It felt good.
Do you think that anger worked for you musically?
Oh, completely.
Yeah.
I do now. Mm-hmm. At the time, we didn't analyze anything. It was just going for... it was going with the heart is what we called it, you know. It was whatever was coming out at the time. You know, I can't change what has happened, you know. Everything that has happened in our career, you know, as far as angry lyrics or whatever it was coming out subliminally even, that happened for a reason. It all happened for a reason for us to get where we are now, to realize, wow, that we were very... very immature in a way, but writing about it, you know, not knowing how to grow up or how to change your survival techniques or your tools in life, how to relate to people. And, you know, it took the band almost breaking up to realize a lot of things. And one was our form of expression and what a gift we have in that. And, you know, after getting clean and sober, going back and reading a lot of the lyrics, going, wow, that's pretty intense. And I can't believe there's some fans out there that really like this, you know.
Give me an example of what you're thinking.
Oh, well, something like A Dyer's Eve. This is a song about my parents and how they kept me in a cocoon, you know, not allowing me to see the world or what different religions there were or different kinds of people or, you know, for me, learning about other things was not. They were trying to keep me in a, almost like a cult type mm-hmm. of religion, mm-hmm. it felt like to me. And this song talks about, you know, now that you're gone, I'm out here in the world and lost, and I'm scared, and, you know, I blame you completely. And a lot of blame put onto my parents, you know, at that point. And it's pretty heavy stuff when I read it now. And, you know, but I realized my parents were doing the best they could with what they had to work with, you know. I didn't realize the trickle-down effect from their parents, you know. You know, you look at your parents as they're gods in a way, you know. They could never do wrong, you know. But looking back and realizing that, yeah, they made some mistakes, but they did the best they could. And let me sort out those mistakes and try and not repeat them.
Well, why don't we hear that song? This is Metallica.
Dear mother, dear father, what is this hell you have put me through? Believe a deceiver, day in, day out, live my life through you. Pushed under me, what's wrong or right? Hidden from this thing that they call life.
So, okay, so that song speaks a bit about your parents. You know, your mother's dad, your father's still alive?
No, he's passed away. He passed away about 12 years ago or so.
Did you write this before he died, or?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
What did he think when he heard it?
I don't know, and I really didn't care. Uh-huh. We didn't connect again for a long time.
Right.
And it was somewhat difficult trying to figure out, what is this relationship? What is it? Am I supposed to hate him still? You know, he's my dad. I love him, but dude, I mean, you screwed us over. You left, took all our money, enough that my mom couldn't survive, and she worried herself sick and eventually died and kind of was left hanging. And a lot of the stuff I was mad about was really him not teaching me how to be a man or a boy or whatever it was. And I had to figure it all out by myself, I felt, you know, and I wasn't ready for it. But I worked a lot of that anger out and some therapy things, which was really helpful. But yeah, you know, our relationship was very strange. After he left, it devastated me, you know. Well, he came back probably 6 months or to a year later, and he was, you know, he was midlife crisis dad, you know, had the stingray and the funky haircut. He shaved, and who's this guy, you know, bringing me gifts from Europe, you know, and Hawaii, and meanwhile, we're struggling, you know.
Right.
So we had a strange relationship. Eventually, got to be somewhat friends again, but it was never resolved. The stuff wasn't never resolved.
My guest is James Hetfield of Metallica. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with James Hetfield, Metallica's lead singer and guitarist. Our interview was recorded in 2004 after the DVD release of the documentary Some Kind of Monster. It chronicled a difficult period in the band's life. Everyone was so angry with each other, the band hired a therapist who usually worked with sports teams to help them figure out what to do. In this scene from the documentary, the band is listening back to one of their rehearsal tapes. Hetfield doesn't like what the drummer Lars Ulrich is playing. Ulrich isn't very enthusiastic about the guitar playing. It hasn't been a good day.
Just real confusing sound.
It's just jacking the vocals all up. I mean, it's clever and everything, but I don't see what it does to it.
I think that's how you hear it, dude. I mean, that's fine. I'm just trying to do something different.
I mean, I'm used to having the drummer do the beat part. You know what I mean? Holding it together.
What I'm hearing is, let me choose my words carefully here. It's pretty straightforward. You know, the guitar shit, it's, you know, it's a little stock. So I started trying to introduce some kind of edge to it from the drums.
Those things we throw out to each other are complete bullshit. You know, it sounds too stock. It sounds too normal to me. You know what I mean? You're saying this shit so you can get your point across about doing a drum beat. I mean, you know, it doesn't hold any water.
To you.
It doesn't.
I think it's f***ing stock. Which part of that is unclear to you? I think it sounds stock to my ears. I mean, you want me to write it down? I feel stock,
I
okay?
Can't hear you.
So I...
No, when you say, you're telling me what to play right now. You're telling me you should play with what Kirk's doing, and I'm telling you it's stock.
Dude, fine.
You know what, guys? Why don't we just go in there and just hammer it out, all right, instead of hammering on each other? This is so silly. You're just sitting there going, I'm in a really pissy mood, and you're just sitting there being a complete
You're really helping matters. You're really good at that. I was straight up with you, and I told you I'm in a shit mood, and what have you been doing? Picking at me all night.
Come on, guys. We've got better things to do. Right?
Yeah, I do. I do.
So this moment in the documentary, you're really angry, you walk out, and then you're going to rehab and you don't come back for 11 months later. When you walked out of the room, did you know that you were headed to rehab after that?
Yeah. Yeah. It's somewhat deceiving in the movie that, you know, I slammed that door. You know, Bob came out and we had a talk. You know, eventually I came back another time and I talked about how things weren't going well at home, how I'd got thrown out of the house. And a lot of that revolved around that and how things in the band weren't going well or at home. And just, wow, how lost I felt. My whole world was shaking under me. You know, all of the roots, the foundations that I felt I had in my life. And I came back and I talked to them that, hey, I've you know, after so-and-so date, I have to go away. I have to work on myself.
Right.
And they knew. I couldn't just leave, you know, that was not right, but it was discussed. Mm-hmm. And I told them, you know, I don't know how long it's going to be, and I don't know, you're gonna have to trust me on this. I just know I have to go and just, you know, I have to rebuild my life. I have to strip down. I had no idea what was in store for me, really, but I knew I had to get some help.
Were you like a star in the rehab unit?
That was the hugest fear out of everything.
What, that you'd be or that you'd not be?
That I would be.
Mm-hmm.
That, and it's so silly now to think about it, but at that time, you know, for me, the biggest fear was, you know, I had tried therapy before and to stop drinking and my just destructive behaviors. I wasn't really ready for it, and I thought, well, that doesn't really work for me. You know, my wife says, you got to check yourself in somewhere. You got to go to a hospital or a rehab or something. It's like, no way. Don't you know who I am, kind of thing? You know, I wouldn't get real treatment there. You know, I couldn't do that. And my fear was that I couldn't. There was no help for me. And I was, of course, creating that fear for myself to continue my behavior, you know. But when I went there, I checked in under a different name, did all that stuff, you know, had the tag on that said, hi, my name is Frank, blah, blah, whatever it was. And at the first meeting they had in there, people went around the room saying their names and what, you know, was going on in their lives. And I just said, you know what? My name's James, and I got a fake tag on, and this is crap, and I'm here to get some help, and I'm fearful of this and this and this. And I broke down crying, and I told people my fears, and, man, they were just right behind me saying, don't worry about it, you know? You're human. We're all humans in here struggling. And that right then, I knew I was in the right place.
My guest is James Hetfield of Metallica. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with James Hetfield, Metallica's lead singer and guitarist. It was recorded in 2004 after the DVD release of the documentary Some Kind of Monster, which chronicled the period when Metallica hired a therapist to work out problems in the band. Whose idea in the band was it to actually hire a therapist and have have the band work through its issues like a couple might go to a marriage counselor.
It pretty much is a marriage counselor. Well, Mr. Toll, he was a therapist. He didn't have a therapist license. He was an enhancement coach, which was, you know, another form of, you know, attitude adjustment, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But basically that told us that he could give feedback, you know, and eventually it was tough to kind of find the boundary of friend and, you know, whatever, hired coach.
Mm-hmm.
But he came on board when our management Q Prime called and said, "What do you think about this?" You know, he's worked with another one of our acts, and we got to get talking, you know, because that was the big deal. There was no communication, you know, over the years of this machine of Metallica rolling on. We discovered that, say, a band like a Guns N' Roses, they're in each other's face. They're very vocal about their attitudes, their thinking, their feelings. We said, we can't do that. You know, look at them. And they eventually break up. So we're not going to do that. So we shut up for years and years and years. And that was self-destructive as well. We had to communicate. So we got this guy, Phil Toll, to come in. He was like a mediator in a way. He kind of made the room safe, neutralized the room. So he helped us talk to each other because there was a lot of diffusing of bombs in the early days. So much baggage, tons, heavy stuff from years and years, a resentment that had just crushed our creativity and our friendships.
Was there something that the therapist actually helped you understand about the relationship of the members of the band that you don't think would have emerged without him?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, when he brought up the word ego, I looked at Lars. He looked at me, you know. And then we had to look at each other, ourselves, you know.
Right.
We had to look in the mirror. Like, okay, yeah, all right. I'll own a little bit of that. And eventually it's like, yeah, you know what? We've both driven each other to certain just egotistical giants, you know. And thank God Kirk, you know, was such the referee through life, you know. And Jason obviously didn't fit in because he was like the minor ego, you know, and it was out of balance, you know, it seemed like. But yeah, that was a shock somewhat. And yeah, you know, I brought up the words, you know, ogre or intimidator, you know, and how I hated being that person. I want to have friends. Why don't I have friends? And they're telling me, well, you're like this. It's like, well, no, I'm not. I don't want to be that. How do I not be that? And that's when I realized that was a tool I brought with me since childhood, you know, intimidate. Man, my dad was pretty darn good at that. He'd just shoot a look and that was all. That's all you needed to know. And that, you know, it was such a great tool to not have to get to know people, you know. I didn't have to get friendly with anyone. Intimacy was so scary. And it still is, you know. It gets so close to someone, what if they leave? I would be crushed, you know. It's like the amount of love that you give, to me, equated the amount of hurt when they left, you
right.
know. And it's still... I still struggle with that.
You know what I find interesting? Like the kind of fan who relates to like the persona that you created, like the mythic version of yourself, the onstage version of yourself, and they're trying to model themselves on somebody who you're not even. Do you know
funny.
What I mean? It's like, this is something like you created. It works really well on stage, but it's not what you are off stage. And they're trying to be that onstage person.
Yeah, it is. It is quite a strange cycle. And, you know, for me, there are parts of me on the stage that are certainly me. There's, you know, there's somewhat of a hat or jacket that you put on
right,
to go
yeah,
up
yeah.
and perform. We're
yeah.
performers.
Yeah, yeah.
But with a real heart. And, you know, it's all really about the music. But when fans come to see you play, they want to see something. They you can't just stand there and play. You could, but it's not as entertaining as running around or showing on your face some of the anger of a song or some of the sadness on a song or some of the thing. It is performing. And then when they meet you at the airport, you're waiting for your bags and, you know, they come up to you, hi, how's it going? And you're, you know, kind of tired from a flight and you're shaking hands and they're like, wow, you're not what I thought you were. And instantly, it's like, why do I feel depressed about that, you know? So you think I should jump on the turn wheel and like smash some bags or what should I do, you know? And I'm not going to do that, you know. It's, you know, yeah, this is me and maybe I'm in a crabby mood, so go away. Or, you know, whatever it may be. Or, hey, I'm in a great mood, come over here, let's take a picture. And, you know, it's subjective to moods at times. And but when people get disappointed for meeting you, that's so strange. And but I've owned what part is mine and what is theirs, because, you know, they've got something built up in their head that they need for their life. Mm-hmm. And if it's not that they meet, they're disappointed in what they've built up for themselves. And sometimes that's a tough reality check. And, you know, so I leave that with them. But I also am nice and say, hey, you know, this is another part of me.
James Hetfield, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
James Hetfield is Metallica's lead singer and guitarist. Our hard rock and heavy metal series continues through Labor Day, when we'll hear from Alice Cooper. Friday's lineup will include stars of Spinal Tap. You can download podcasts of our show by going to our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. From the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation, supporting educational, cultural, and environmental initiatives to make our world more livable. On the web at grdodge.org. And from TIAA CREF, putting the heart of a nonprofit to work for the financial future of those who serve the greater good. That's powerof.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Way, way down inside. On the next Fresh Air, we continue our hard rock and heavy metal series. Led Zeppelin's Robert Plant reveals the true meaning of Stairway to Heaven, and Aerosmith's Steven Tyler and Joe Perry describe life in one of the most successful and self-destructive hard rock bands. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.